Tonight on Arena, John Banville brings us on a trip to Prague by book, and we review drummer Chris Francis' biog of Talking Heads. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. On recent Monday nights, we've been having our virtual European city breaks using books as our mode of transport. Last week, Maeve Kennedy showed us around London in three different eras using novels by Daniel Defoe, Marjorie Allingham and Aminata Fornet. Tonight, we're off to Prague with John Banville and three books, none of which are novels, incidentally. So maybe we're breaking our own rules a little bit, but there's no harm in that, is there? John Banville, delighted to have him join me now on the line. Prague, a place you know very well, I think it's safe to say, John. You wrote about it in Prague Pictures in 2003. You also have an interest in characters that have spent time in that city in history, not least of whom is Kepler, the great astronomer. When did your interest with Prague begin? How did that start?
Oh, when I was reading about Kepler, doing some background reading for the novel that I wrote about him, and I discovered that Rudolf in Prague around 1600, when the Emperor Rudolf II was in charge, one of the most strange creatures ever to run the Holy Roman Empire. It was an extraordinary time. He collected magicians, alchemists, as well as, you know, unicorn's horns and various things like that. It was an extraordinary time in Prague. Prague is a very strange city. Now, Praguers themselves get a bit annoyed when you start talking about it as being a magical city. It was anciently known as one of the three capitals of magic in Europe, the other two being Lyon and Turin. Not sure why, but there you are. It certainly is a strange-looking city. Before the tourists destroyed it, it was one of those strange places where you walked along an avenue and you turned down a side street and you could hear your own footsteps in the centre of the city. That's not true of many places. It is an odd city.
And when did you first travel there? Did you find it magical in its reality when you travelled?
Well, I had written about it before I went. And when I went, I thought, yeah, I invented this quite well. And, you know, I put this city in place here. Early 80s, late 70s, early 80s. It was an entirely different city then. It was very sad. I mean, people were very sad. They were... The communist regime was terrible, truly, truly terrible. But they lived very rich intellectual lives. You know, ideas mattered, books mattered, fiction mattered, poetry mattered, the truth in literature mattered. I'm not sure that's the case anymore. Perhaps it is. I hope it is. But it has, I mean, the city has largely been destroyed by tourism.
And
like so many cities.
Yeah, when do you think that destruction took place? Are you talking about...
After 89.
Yeah, 20th century, late 20th century.
Yeah.
Okay, well,
it's a great pity, you know. It is a very beautiful city, will continue to be a beautiful city. I would love to see it now when it's empty. But unfortunately, I won't.
No, I don't think too many people will get to see it, unfortunately, in the current situation, which is why we travel there by book.
That's a good introduction to Rivellino's, Angelo Maria Rivellino's Magic Prague, because he wrote the book in the '70s. He was a great Italian scholar of German language literature. He was absolutely wholly in love with Prague, but he couldn't go there. He wasn't allowed in. So, Magic Prague by Rivellino is a love story to a lost love, a love song to a lost love. It's passionate. It's probably overwritten. I don't know how good the scholarship is. I can't say. But as a hymn of praise to a distant beloved, it is. It's just irresistible. I mean, look, in places, it's so clotted with facts and names and places that, you know, you want to throw it at the wall. But you stick with it because of his enthusiasm, his extraordinary love for this extraordinary city.
And where
he goes right through from the Emperor Rudolf II, he goes through from the beginning, but he concentrates a lot on Rudolf II, whom I think he really loved. He said of Rudolf II that he lived amidst an endless bustle of astrologers, distillers, automatons, necromancers, architects, knaves, ghosts, Jesuits, puppets, waxworks, and sandstone saints.
Not much left after that, is there?
That's just the beginning of it, believe me.
What was Ripollino's... did he have a personal connection with the city?
Well, curiously, he was professor of Russian language and literature and in Czech language and literature at the University of Rome. And most of his books are on Russian literature. But obviously, he knew Czech intimately, and he knew Czech literature intimately. And he was just crazy about the place. It's a sad book in some ways because he says, you know, I sometimes go to the eastern borders and I just look across into what was then Czechoslovakia and I weep, you know, knowing that I would never get to see Prague. And he didn't. He died in 78. If only he'd lived another 12 years or so, he'd be able to go.
So he actually never got to visit the city that he wrote so dearly about?
Oh, no, he did visit. He knew it very well. Oh. But... obviously, he said something that the authorities didn't like.
Right.
I mean, look, when I was writing a book about Copernicus, and I wanted to go to Poland, and I applied to the Polish embassy in London because we didn't have one here. And they said, "Of course you can come. Of course we'll give you a visa," which they did 6 weeks after my flight left. So that was their way of not allowing me in. You know, we forget, and the young probably don't know, how dreadful Eastern Europe was. Even to say Eastern Europe, I remember a Hungarian friend of mine saying, "Oh, Eastern Europe, where does that begin? Is it in Moscow? Is it in Berlin? Is it in Paris? Is it in Dublin? You know, where does the East begin?" And I stood corrected. He said, you know, there is just Europe. It was communism that made an Eastern Europe out of Europe.
Well, I guess there are those who would argue, too, that Western Europe created itself as well, not just that Eastern Europe created itself.
Well, how much time have you got?
That's a Kafka question, really, in some ways, isn't it? Which was created first, Europe or Eastern Europe? And it's hardly surprising that Kafka should be one of your... In fact, Kafka is part of your next two choices. But let's go to the original Kafka, if you like, first of all, and Metamorphosis, 1915. What kind of Prague was Kafka writing about in that long, short story?
He was, of course, a German speaker. He had very little Czech language. But he, you know, he admired the Czech people. He didn't feel superior. He worked as an insurance clerk. He drudged as an insurance clerk. He was one of the strangest human beings that one could read about. And Metamorphosis is... It's so marvelous because for people who haven't read it, their first surprise would be just how calm the tone is. You know, Gregor Samsa wakes up one morning and he's turned into a giant insect. In fact, the German word is vermin. He's turned into a piece of vermin. And he thinks, oh, this is all very odd. I think I'll have a little sleep. Maybe it'll go away. He has a little sleep. It doesn't go away. And he's looking at his little legs. He's lying on his back and he's looking at his little legs twirling around. Kafka doesn't specify what kind of beetle it was. Somebody calls him a dung beetle at one stage. Vladimir Nabokov had many theories of what it was. I think that it's a woodlouse, what it was turned into. But, you know, Gregor Samsa, the clerk working in the city of Prague, wakes up one morning, he's become a giant insect, and, you know, because he's late for work, the chief clerk of his office comes to the house and says, "Where is he?" He finally sees Gregor and flees. His family are appalled, of course. But everything is taken as, you know, it's all an annoyance. Nobody ever comments on the fact that this is completely impossible and completely grotesque. It's simply an inconvenience. And as the story goes on, it gets more and more sad as poor Gregor, trapped in his room, which becomes increasingly filthy. His sister, who treats him well at the beginning, turns against him. One of the most awful little details, and Kafka was wonderful at details. his father throws an apple at him, and it sticks in his back, and it stays there, and it rots, and it makes him very ill. That was the kind of thing Kafka was marvellously good at. It was tiny, ordinary, everyday details that make the grotesquery and the horror of his stories so much more acute.
And to what extent, I mean, it's possibly easy for us sitting in 2020 to look back at 1915 or that kind of second decade of the 20th century and say, oh yeah, Kafka was obviously writing about the awful situation that Europe was heading into. To what extent do you think he was commenting in that, in Metamorphosis in particular, on the Prague of the day, the situation in which, the political situation in which he was living?
Yeah, well, in the introduction to the collected stories, John Updike reports Kafka talking to a friend of his, and the friend said, now this is after the First World War, you know, 1920s. He says to him, you know, is your work prophetic of the future? And he says, Kafka put his hands over his face. He says, yes, they are. That's why they must be destroyed. I think that's a rather fanciful story. I think the world became Kafkaesque without Kafka knowing about it. I don't think he knew something was coming, probably. I mean, even if you listen to music of Mahler from the late 19th century, early 20th century, you can hear a horrified sense, you know, another Jew looking to the future and perhaps wondering, perhaps having some foreknowledge, but nobody could have foretold Hitler.
Do you have any sense of, you know, given the situation we're currently in, clearly a pandemic, you know, a global situation, but beyond that, the political situation, that there's a lot of anxiety around as well. Do you have any sense of anybody writing or anybody in the artistic world at the moment who seems to be presaging something of more, whatever, more appalling proportions to come?
Well, I hope to goodness nobody's writing about COVID-19. You know, fiction, poetry, they have to wait till afterwards. People imagine that novels and literature is relevant to its time. It's not. It's relevant to a timeless time. I think it would be very foolish, especially as we're in the midst of something. But, you know, I lived through the Cuban Missile Crisis in the early 60s when, you know, it looked for quite a few days as if this was the end. I remember going with my mother to an exhibition of amateur paintings in Wexford, and it was the most serious night of the crisis. And I distinctly remember saying to myself, I don't know what, perhaps about 16 or so, saying to myself, my God, this is the last experience I'm going to have amateur paintings in Wexford. We all had that sense. So, you know, it's not new. After Rudolf II's death, began the 30 Years' War, the Wars of Religion in Europe, which very, very nearly destroyed the continent, very nearly burnt it to the ground. Human beings, you know, we destroy each other, and then Mother Nature gets fed up and says, all right, I'll teach them a lesson, and sends us something like this to put manners on us.
So you think there's a sense of which this is a little lesson to warn us we're not in charge.
Well, I hope we would learn something from it, but of course we won't. We'll forget about it. I mean, the Spanish flu epidemic went from 1918 up to 1920 and killed between 50 and 100 million people. And after it came the Roaring Twenties. So there'll be the Roaring, whatever it is, this is over.
The Roaring 30s, maybe the Roaring 20s, the roaring late 20s. Let's go to your final choice then, and we're in Kafka land again. This time it's a three-volume biography. Rainer Stach, is that how I say Stach?
Rainer Stach, yeah.
What particularly about this three-volume biography, apart from the fact that it would be very useful during lockdown if you wanted a good long read, what is it about this and the way it tells the Kafka story that particularly attracts you?
Yeah, I hesitated to recommend three hefty volumes of biography of anybody to general readers in a time like this. But this work is an absolute masterpiece. It's unique among biographies. He set out to give you a sense of what it was like to be Kafka. And by the end of the three volumes, you know exactly what it was like to be Kafka. It is, I think, a great work of art. not just a biography. Wonderfully readable, absolutely fascinating in its detail, and in its portrait of a time and of a place, and of an exceedingly strange man who manages to make, by the time you finish the book, Kafka doesn't seem strange anymore. He just seems to be Kafka. So, I mean, he had a hard time writing. It took him 20 years. He had to publish volume 2 and 3 before he published volume 1 because he couldn't get his hands on the archives. His difficulty in getting the archives is, I'm afraid I have to say, a Kafkaesque story, which is much too long to go into here. But he persevered. He got the documents at last, and he wrote a superlative first volume as third volume. And I would certainly start with
volume 3, yeah?
No, I would start, yeah, start with volume 3. Yeah. But really, do readers, general readers, especially in Canada, give it a try. You know, if you don't get on with it after 30 or 40 pages, move to something else. But I think that
it's
most
worth.
Readers will be absolutely hooked by then.
And just in terms of the Prague that Rash, or Stach rather, gives us in the book, do we get a sense of the city?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Rainer Stach knows Prague like the back of his hand, probably better than the back of his hand. The last time I was in Prague, a couple of years ago, he showed me a lot of places where Kafka had been, where he lived, which I hadn't even known about, and I've been to Prague a lot of times. So, yes, you know, and also he's a superlatively good writer. I mean, you know, this is as good as any writing in fiction or non-fiction.
I know it's all...
I
was going to say, I know it's all to say, why didn't you choose? But just one question, I suppose a lot of people, when they hear Prague, particularly contemporary literature, they'll think pretty quickly of Milan Kundera and The Unbearable Lightness of Being. Do you just not like that book, or are the other three beyond above it?
Well, I could make puns based on the title, but I won't. I don't rate his work terribly highly. I think it was fashionable in its time, and it gave people a sense that they were dealing in, you know, high intellectual matters, but I don't think that's the case. On the other hand, I mean, you know, it is a good book, but it's not, compared to the three books that I've chosen, it doesn't rate, I'm afraid.
Finally, John, how is lockdown treating you? Is writing, does it continue afoot, or is it in pause?
Oh, of course I write, my goodness. I've been in lockdown since I started to write when I was 13 or 14. Nothing new to me. You know, I'm perfectly happy sitting in my little room, scribbling away, as I've been doing for the best part of 60 years and more.
Well, look, we look forward to whatever comes out of the current scribbling away that's happening. And thanks for giving us your Prague choices this evening. That's John Banville. And John's three Prague books are Metamorphosis by Franz Kafka, Magic Prague by Angelo Maria Ripolino, and then Rainer Stach's three-volume biography of Kafka. And then next Monday, Daryl Jones takes us on a tour to the city of Florence by book. Australian singer-songwriter, composer and author Nick Cave has been close to the hearts of many Irish music fans for the guts of four decades now. Unfortunately, like so much else this year, his Three Arena show, which was scheduled for May, had to be postponed. But his Irish fans, and indeed fans around the world, will have the opportunity to see this superstar at a special global streaming event this Thursday evening, July the 23rd. Idiot Prayer, Nick Cave Alone at Alexandra Palace, was filmed last month by one of our own highly respected cinema exports, cinematographer Robbie Ryan, Oscar winner from 2018 for The Favourite, his work on that film. So we're dealing with a considerable talent in this one-off streaming event in the person of both Cave, obviously, and Robbie Ryan. This is a ticketed affair, features Nick Cave performing 20 songs from his catalogue solo at the piano, filmed at a grand room at Alexandra Palace in London. It's a one-off. It won't be available on any platforms after Thursday night. When you buy the ticket, you are given a link for your computer alone. And the good news is, for one Arena listener tonight, we have a link to give away to Thursday's performance. Plus, a pair of tickets to the rescheduled Nick Cave show at the Three Arena in Dublin on Saturday, April the 21st of next year, of 2021. So to win those tickets, text to 51551 your answer to the following question, please. In October last year, we reviewed Nick Cave's last album. What is the title of that album? 51551, we'll announce the winner at the end of tonight's show. In the meantime, here's a track from the album. It's called Waiting For You.
To return.
Waiting For You from Nick Cave, and that from his album released back in last October. I'm not giving you the title of the album because that is our competition question this evening. Your chance to win the link to that amazing performance at Alexandra Palace streaming this Thursday evening, and also tickets, a pair of tickets to the rescheduled Nick Cave at the Three Arena on Saturday, April the 21st of next year. 51551 with that album title to be in with a chance of winning. The Dublin City Arts Office has just announced its artists' residencies for 2020-2021. Among the recipients are the Breadland Collective Theatre Company, Etna Jordan, the artist, and theatre maker, singer-songwriter Dylan Tagg. There are three others as well. We'll get to those in a moment. But for the time being, I'd like to speak to two of those who are the current artists in residence for the Dublin City Arts Office. They are Jane Deasy and Michael Gallen, both of whom join me on the line now. I'll start with you, Jane. You're coming to the end of it's a 2-year period, I think, you had the residency for. I think security was the word that jumped out of what you had said about what the residency gave to you. What exactly did you mean when you said security was the big thing you got?
Yeah, security and stability, which are hard to find as an artist these days living in Dublin. So I've been here for coming up to 18 months, and having a workspace to wake up to in the morning has been extremely valuable for me and my practice. And having an extended period of time in this space has meant that I have been really able to delve into things that I've been wanting to work on for a long time without the stress and pressure of having to look for a space to do that in.
And when you say I've been here, you're talking about Albert Cottages, which are they within the DCU campus out around the Glasnevin Finglas area?
Yeah, they are. They're just in that park there, Albert Park. And it's a beautiful place to live. It's very much like you're living in the countryside, and but also close to town and close to the places, the other places that I was working. So it was really ideal.
And in fact, your next door neighbour is the other person who I'm speaking to this evening, Michael Gallen. Your cottage next door to Jane's, Michael.
I am indeed, Sean, yeah.
And how would you describe the kind of what Jane talked about, security there? What did the space give you over the past 2 years? Coming to an end in August of this year, isn't it?
Yeah, I've been in the cottage here for just over a year, and I suppose just to echo what Jane has said, I've found in Dublin over the past 5-6 years that often when I've been taking on larger scale pieces of work, I've had to leave the city and rent a cottage somewhere in the middle of nowhere in order to get the work done. I suppose just to have the space to work in, and also the aural space when you're composing. And what's unusual about this residency is that it's set in a park. So you do feel that you have that capacity to really settle and listen. So it's been very valuable for that. And I think very unusual for Dublin. You know, you'd love to see more spaces like this for artists around the city.
You're originally from Monaghan. People can probably hear that in the accent. So I guess for any artist not from Dublin originally, it really is quite a task. And even for those from Dublin, who wants to be necessarily living with their parents just so that they can pursue their artistic practice?
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose I'm in my early 30s, and there is a point as an artist where you feel like you want to ascend to a level of adulthood that your peers and other lines of work would have. And that is quite hard in Dublin at the moment, just because of the rental situation. So it's great that Dublin City Council have provided this. You know, I think that certainly, you know, when you have a larger space, sometimes it gives you more capacity to imagine larger ideas. And I know that, you know, having discussed it with Jane as well, that I think it is something that allowed us maybe to mature as artists in a way that isn't as possible in a house share, you know, somewhere in the city centre.
Yeah, and again, you've both mentioned this idea of silence, Jane, and kind of the space to let things happen. Just to get that, your own background in terms of geography, if you like. I know that you had studied music and theatre in Trinity, first of all, and then you did a master's at the Glasgow School of Art. Did you come home from...
Yeah.
Where are you from originally?
I'm from Cork originally, and I moved to Dublin just after my leaving cert to study music and theatre, yeah.
So you've go ahead.
Yeah, and then I, since then, have been living in Dublin, apart from the 1 year in Glasgow.
Right, yeah, so yeah. Dublin has been, and you would echo many of the things that Michael is saying there, just about the rental situation.
Absolutely, yeah. Everyone is obviously very aware of the housing crisis at the moment that we're all living through. One of the things that I really found most valuable about this house and studio space was, and that I just want to mention for other people, is that there was no obligation on us to produce a specific piece of work by a deadline. And not having that pressure was an amazing opportunity to explore certain parts of your work that you don't get to do when you are working to a deadline. And as Michael has said, that is invaluable if you are at a certain point in your career and you need to mature and develop your work specifically. So that was an amazing part.
Yeah, was it from this period of time then that your a composition that you've just completed on cassette, in fact, Notes from the Bath, did that come directly out of your period under this residency?
Yeah, it did. I've started building digital instruments, and one of which I composed Notes from the Bath on, and that's what I've been mostly working on in the residency, is researching and developing new instruments that I can perform and compose with. I started looking into that when I was in Glasgow, and have really developed it now since being here. And yeah, it's funny, translating the digital sounds onto a tape, usually it's the other way around. But
absolutely. Yeah, yeah. And I think one of the interesting things, I listened to a large section of the piece today. It's not the kind of thing you can take an excerpt from, really, because it demands what you're talking about. It demands that. It's certainly the section I saw was 30 minutes long, but I think part one and part two, it adds up to an hour. But you really have to sit and listen to it, because it grows from silence into the electrical sound, the electronic sound that it grows into. It takes it almost an hour to do that. So you need the time and the space to listen to it as well as to compose it, I guess.
Yeah, very much so. And I think having it on tape really suits that because of how you engage with music on a tape. You know, I think it's a nice experience. And yeah, it does. It grows from practically nothing, as you said, over an hour, and becomes a more intricate kind of layered textural piece.
And you have to get the sense of it, you really have to give it the time. You can't just say, hey, here's a bit from the middle. It was quieter before that, and it's louder towards the end of it. Let's talk a little bit of what I think you had possibly started on elsewhere, or certainly part of it. Your opera, Michael, had already been, was it in train when you moved into the residency?
It was somewhat, Sean. I had gone, so the opera is based on the story of the 1919 Monaghan Asylum Soviet, which is when the staff in now St. Avenant's Hospital in Monaghan took over the hospital and formed a Soviet in 1919. So I had gone on a couple of research trips. I went over and stayed in a psychiatric hospital in Switzerland for a few months, just to kind of get a better sense of the patient experience. But I hadn't really settled into the composition of the piece. For a lot of last year, I was on tour with a dance piece called Session. And was trying to compose bits and pieces of it in hotel rooms and, you know, on residencies of a week or 2 weeks. So really, it's only been since I came to the cottage here that I had, you know, the time to really sort of allow the piece to grow of its own accord.
It's an amazing story. I know, I don't know if you knew about, there was a Limerick Soviet as well, which was Mike Finn had a play about that about 2 years ago, I think it is, at this point in time. But the Monaghan Soviet one, not that I'm being parochial, but I think it predated the Limerick one, didn't it?
It did, yeah. It was actually the first Soviet to take place outside of the newly established Soviet Union. Mm. So, you know, Monaghan is ever on the cutting edge of
Michael.
I suppose, yeah, I came across the piece in 2016, or I came across the story in 2016. I was composing a piece for the centenary and just was fascinated by, you know, these radical ideas that were there at the time. You know, Padraig O'Donnell had come in to lead the Soviet and, you know, among the things that they were asking for was pay equity between men and women and, you know, more humane working conditions. And a lot of that was against a backdrop, you know, very similar to our own now, in that the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic was still, you know, really at its worst. So I just was drawn to the story and, you know, feel that there's a very interesting lens to look at 20th century Ireland, you know, through that moment where there's a sort of imagined future, you know, sort of imagining the, you know, what the future would be like in this forgotten past.
I want to listen to a little section from it. You sent us two bits today. I want to listen to a section from what's called the negotiations scene. And obviously, if we're in a Soviet and we're talking about employees and employers, we can probably guess what the negotiations are about here. But through whose eyes do we actually hear this opera? Is this a real person? Is this a person who actually was in what was appallingly referred to as the lunatic asylum at the time?
No, actually, you know, as I delved further and further into the story, I realized that the absent voice often is the one of the patient or the resident in the hospital. And I suppose having read books like Bird's Nest Soup by Hannah Greeley, I wanted to focus more on what it would be like to be a patient at the time of the Soviets and, you know, have this moment of hope and then to live through subsequent decades where the opposite is the case. So the main character is a woman called Celine, who's a patient in the hospital and who decades later is locked into the moment of the Soviets and hears voices and imagines herself to be Padraig O'Donnell. And so the events in the Soviet are sort of told through her visions and reminiscences.
So if we go to the negotiation scene then, what are we hearing here?
So it's the first negotiation scene of two in the opera. And this is the scene begins with her in a very prosaic context as a patient. And she hears the staff behind her complaining about their working conditions. And over the course of their complaint, she kind of basically builds herself into this frenzy. Mm. And this is the first moment where she manifests the spirit of Padraig O'Donnell and tells them that they should barricade the gates and lock themselves in.
And that's a section there from one of the negotiation scenes in Michael Gallen's opera, Michael Gallen and Jane. I can't find Jane's second name. Sorry, Jane Deasy here with me, are talking with me this evening about their artist in residence with the Dublin City Arts Office just coming to an end. I love the lock the gate bit there. Good, strong Monaghan accent. Is that Dara Halpin shouting that out for us? Plays the part of Celine, Michael, doesn't she?
Yeah, that's Dara. And, Dara's a wonderful performer. And, you know, really sort of took the role very seriously, or the research for the role. So we did 2 weeks of development it's a French ensemble. They're co-producers with my company Straymaker up in Monaghan last November. And I think Dara was soaking in the accent in the hotel every morning and
obviously
channeled it through the character.
You recorded it at that time. That's how we could get the big ensemble and all of the instruments and players and singers together.
Yeah, we at the end of those 2 weeks, we did a work in progress concert performance in Castle Blaney.
All right. Well, listen, congratulations to both of you. Sorry that your residencies are coming to an end, but I'm sure you'll be happy for those who have or are getting them this year. Lewis Barfoot, the Breadline Collective, Cara Dunn, Kamin Gilmore, Etna Jordan and Dylan Tighe. You've certainly whetted the appetite of many artists around the place who would like to find out more about the residencies. And you can do so by going to the City Arts website. I'll get that for you actually during the break because I just can't find it right now. But that was Jane Deasy and Michael Gallen. Now, I finally found that website on my pages in front of me. DublinCityArtsOffice.ie is where you'll find out the details of the Dublin Artist Residency and the details of the those who got it this year. But you can find out how you could apply maybe for the next set. You can also find out more about Jane Deasy's work on fortevilfruit.bandcamp.com and michaeljgallen.com for further details on Michael's opera, which it's hoped will premiere at the Abbey next year. Fronted by the towering musical figure of David Byrne, Talking Heads was a transformative band that brought soul, gospel, dance and other types of music into post-punk rock in the world of 1970s New York. In a new book, Remain in Love, the band's drummer, Chris France, gives us his experience with the band, writes about his love affair with the bassist Tina Weymouth, with whom he also founded Tom Tom Club, but he also talks about a more turbulent relationship with Byrne. Roisin Dwyer has been reading the book for us and I'll speak to her in a minute about it. But when we think of Talking Heads, we think of several songs, but I think probably the first one that comes to mind is this one. There we go, Talking Heads and Psycho Killer from their debut album. And Roisin Dwyer has been reading the Remain in Love book. The band's drummer, Chris France, his biog. I'm calling it Roisin a biog of Talking Heads, but it's probably a little bit unfair to refer to it just as that, is it?
Yeah, no, it is Chris France's memoir, which comprises his own life story, the story of Talking Heads, the story of his relationship with Tina Weymouth and creative partnership and their other activities, which is of course the Tom Tom Club and their production activities. So correctly it would be Chris France's memoir.
So let's talk about the Talking Heads bit, because it's what he says about David Byrne. It's well known the kind of difficulties they had with each other, shall we say.
Yes, well, David Byrne is known as quite a difficult character anyway. He's spoken about his own Asperger's and being on the spectrum. But what France reveals, and I'll start off by saying that Chris France is well known as one of the nice guys of rock. He's very, in interviews, and I had the pleasure of interviewing him years ago, very affable, open, down-to-earth guy. And that imbues the whole book actually with this lovely warm convivial tone, which makes for extremely pleasant reading. But he does of course go into the relationship with David Byrne. Now, he met David Byrne at art school in Rhode Island School of Design, where he also met Tina Weymouth. And so from early on, it's very interesting actually, the first time he meets David Byrne, Chris France describes him as having a full Rasputin beard, haircut short by himself, wearing secondhand clothes and barely speaks to anyone, and his nickname is Mad Dave. So, but throughout the whole history of Talking Heads, and actually, let's take Psycho Killer as an example. You know, people think of David Byrne as the creative force, but really, you know, it is it was Tina Weymouth, whose mother was French, and Chris France that contributed most to that song. But it was revised then by David Byrne, as he credited it to himself. And that sort of that early, these early instances go on to set the precedent for Talking Heads. Chris France mentions an early art exhibition where all the participants hung their artworks. When everyone went home, David Byrne went back in and hung his in the front main room of the exhibition space. And that is what you know, that well, tends to repeat itself continuously.
Well, it repeats itself continuously in Chris Francis' telling of it, or do you think others would
say the same thing? Well, it has been alluded to by, well, Tina Weymouth and Jerry Harrison have, you know, said it, and other people that have worked with David Byrne over the years. You know, like Chris Francis actually says, you know, he treated the rest of us in Talking Heads with, you know, this disrespect, continues to do so. I wonder how his new collaborators feel. Tina says he is incapable of returning friendship. We learned this from experience. So he doesn't, like, he doesn't attack Byrne. It's more sort of he shows by various examples.
But does he explain what brought the three of them together in the first place, and what it was that led to Talking Heads, and that, as I said, you know, this kind of the way they brought different forms of music into post-punk
that is
New York.
Very interesting that the Rhode Island Institute of Design, you know, it's, you know, there they're learning about art history, you know, modern contrarians, unconventional approaches, you know, and, you know, avant-garde sensibilities. And you can see how clearly this all fed into Talking Heads, who are, you know, as you mentioned in the introduction, so unusual in that they have a very unusual aesthetic. They draw in all these different strands of world music and funk into sort of this pop rock punk mix. So they meet in college and they're all interested in music, so they form this band called The Artistics, which is David Byrne, Tina Weymouth, Chris Francis and a few others. And after college they end up the three, Byrne, Weymouth and Francis, moving to New York. They get this loft together. You know, the idea is to get, you know, play music. And it really, like, most of, you know, the seminal songs we associate with Talking Heads were written in this grotty loft in the Bowery, where they start out frequenting the famous CBGBs. And there's wonderful stories from there. You know, Chris Francis describes, you know, the early days of CBGBs and bumping into Debbie Harry and, you know, the Ramones, who he mistakenly thinks, without hearing them, are a Mexican band. So it's wonderful.
He also mentions Lou Reed, and I think Andy Warhol gets a mention in there, Grace Jones. Does it become a bit name droppy, or does he do that?
No, because it, you know, it's spread out, and you know, the name dropping isn't gratuitous. You know, he's so Chris Francis is so understated that it's, you know, he's sort of telling the stories with a certain humility. It's not name dropping at all.
And when we get into the 1980s and the track that I want to play now, Burning Down the House, is it all still Rosie and the Gardener, or have they just found a way of working together and making good songs but maybe not having a friendship?
I think, yeah, they are so passionate about making music that they stick together.
And then they can make songs like this.
Exactly.
There we go, Burning Down the House from Talking Heads. And with me in the studio this evening is Roisin Dwyer. She's talking to us about Remain in Love, which is the Chris Francis memoir. Chris Francis, famously the drummer with Talking Heads. And you were saying, Roisin, just before we listened to that piece, or I think I was putting words in your mouth, did they manage just to not have a friendship but to make music together? Did it go sour at any point? Or?
Yes, well, David Byrne sort of decided, like, I think it was, you know, the other three trying to, you know, push the, you know, keep momentum going. And, you know, David Byrne with his self-aggrandizing and, you know, just being obtuse and being obstinate. And like in, I think it was 84, he decided that he didn't want Talking Heads to be a live performance band. And, you know, I think Chris Francis, when he's talking about Live Aid, sort of says, oh, you know, wonder why we weren't on the bill. Oh, that's right. David Byrne decided in 1984.
I get the impression that a bit like Chris Francis, maybe David Byrne isn't on your Christmas card list.
He's not on my Christmas card list, and definitely not after reading this book. It is sort of a sense that they trundle along. And then even the band discovers, like, there's a lot of, are they, aren't they splitting up? And even the band learn secondhand that, you know, David Byrne has said the Talking Heads have called it a day. That's how they find out.
But he said it, nobody else said
it.
And we should talk about Tina Weymouth, because it's clear from this that she is vital to Chris Francis' life, and she is a musician in her own right. All the reviews have referred to her as Chris Francis' wife. She is Tina Weymouth.
Oh,
he is Chris Francis.
That's And that's, you know, so incorrect. She is, like, and we see in this book through the prism of her husband how multi-talented she is, you know, musician, lyricist, songwriter, an artist, creative, a mother, wife, much more. But, you know, she was a woman in a predominantly male world. And there are, you know, lots of incidents of misogyny. There's a famous example when they turn up to produce the first album by Ziggy Marley. And Ziggy Marley turns around to Chris France and say, you know, why does Chris France bring his wife to the session? You know, so, but it is beautiful.
Why does Tina Weymouth bring her husband to the session?
Indeed, yeah. It's beautiful to see their you know, their partnership, which has endured. And, you know, he's still so enthusiastic describing her and their relationship and how great she is. Which
so
is the memoir,
you know, is it even-handed in that respect? Is Talking Heads about a third of the memoir, if you like, or is there more of it on Talking Heads than there is on Tom Tom Club, for example, and
oh,
Tina
yeah,
Weymouth
would,
and Chris France?
The majority of it would be Talking Heads, but a lot of it is Chris France's young life, which I think is always nice to get an insight into, you know, someone's formation. Mm. And, you know, his father was in the military, he moved around a lot, how that informed the person he became and his values and how he carried that on through his career. But, you know, it's a book for Talking Heads fans.
It is for Talking Heads fans.
Yes, yeah.
Is it a book for David Byrne fans?
I don't think so, no. They might like to read it so they can disagree strongly with it or take issue with it, but no, it's not a book for David Byrne fans.
All right. Well, the book is called Remain in Love, Talking Heads, Tom Top Club, Tina. It has that subtitle, which gives you kind of the three parts of the book. Chris France, and it's published by White Rabbit. Roisin Dwyer speaking to us about that book this evening. And so to the lucky winner of our Nick Cave competition, two tickets to see Nick Cave and the Bad Seas in concert next April in Dublin at the Three Arena after the cancellation of this May's event. But also this winner gets a ticket to the streaming event happening this Thursday, a one-off performance by Nick Cave called Idiot Prayer, Nick Cave alone at Alexandra Palace at the piano, just singing songs, filmed last month by Irish cinematographer Robbie Ryan. The answer to the question was, we asked, what's the name of Nick Cave's current album released last October? Do you know the answer, Roisin Dwyer? The album is Ghosting. You wouldn't have won the competition.
I wouldn't have won the competition.
But you know who did know the answer? Gerard Bonner. Or is he Gerard Boner, since he's from Buncrana in County Donegal? He could be either. Congratulations to you, Gerard. You are getting both the tickets to Three Arena and the streaming. Enjoy it. You deserve it. NickCave.com for full information on all of that. That is our lot for this evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Sound supervision this evening was by Mark Dwyer. And tonight's programme was produced by Olin McGann. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7.